At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
The coffee shop is bustling, filled with the low hum of conversation and the hiss of the espresso machine. You step up to the counter, order your usual, and the barista turns the small payment terminal toward you. The screen shows the total, a small, insignificant amount. You pull out a piece of plastic from your wallet, hover it over the screen for a brief moment, and a friendly chirp confirms your payment. "Approved," the screen reads. You grab your coffee and walk away without a second thought. It was an interaction that lasted maybe 3 seconds, utterly mundane and forgettable. But in that brief moment, in the time it took for the machine to beep, a silent, high-speed conversation of incredible complexity just took place across the globe. A request was sent, credentials were checked, identities were verified, and a promise of payment was returned from hundreds or even thousands of miles away. It's one of the most common actions in modern life, but how does it actually work? Welcome back to How Does That Work? In today's episode, we're following the money. We're pulling back the curtain on that simple tap or swipe to uncover the hidden global network that springs into action every single time you use your credit card. So how did we get here? This massive, instantaneous global system feels like it has been with us forever, but its origins are surprisingly recent, and it all started with a forgotten wallet. The year was 1949. A New York businessman named Frank McNamara was hosting a client dinner at a restaurant, and when the bill arrived, he had a moment of sheer panic. He had left his cash at home. To save himself the embarrassment, he had his wife deliver the money, but the incident sparked an idea. He imagined a world where you could pay at restaurants with a single card, a sort of universal IOU. A year later, he returned to that same restaurant and paid with a small cardboard card, the very first Diners Club card. This first card was simple. It was a charge card, meaning the balance had to be paid in full every month, and it was only accepted at a small number of New York restaurants that had partnered with Diners Club. But the idea of pay later convenience was a hit and began to spread. Soon, individual banks started issuing their own credit cards, but they were limited, only working at local stores that had an agreement with that one specific bank. The real revolution came in 1958, when Bank of America decided to try a massive experiment. They chose the city of Fresno, California, and mailed 60,000 unsolicited pre-approved Bank AmeriCard credit cards to its residents. The event, known as the Fresno Drop, was chaotic, but it proved that a general-purpose credit card issued by a bank could work on a large scale. Crucially, this Bank AmeriCard also introduced revolving credit, the ability to carry a balance from 1 month to the next. The final piece of the puzzle was connecting all the different banks. A Bank AmeriCard was great, but it was useless at a store that only worked with a different bank. To solve this, Bank of America began to license its card system to other banks across the country and around the world. In the 1970s, this cooperative alliance of thousands of banks decided to separate and form its own independent organization to manage the growing network. They renamed it Visa. At the same time, a rival group of banks formed their own competing alliance, which would eventually become MasterCard. This was the birth of the global networks we know today, the digital highways that ensure a card issued by a small bank in one country can be instantly accepted at a coffee shop on the other side of the planet. And so, in just a few decades, we went from a simple cardboard rectangle born from an embarrassing moment at a restaurant to the tiny, secure supercomputer in your wallet today. To understand this lightning-fast process, you first have to meet the cast of characters involved in this financial play. There are more players on the stage than you might think. First, there's you, the cardholder. Then there's the merchant, the coffee shop selling you the coffee. Behind the scenes, things get more complicated. The coffee shop has a bank, often called the acquiring bank, which provides them with the payment terminal and accepts payments on their behalf. Then you have your bank, the one that issued you the credit card in the first place. This is called the issuing bank, and connecting these two banks acting as the grand central station of the whole operation, is the card network, like Visa, MasterCard, or American Express. These five players, you, the merchant, the merchant's bank, your bank, and the network, are about to engage in a conversation that will last about 2 seconds. The moment you tap your card, the play begins. But to understand the magic happening now, we first have to remember the old way of doing things, the magnetic stripe. For decades, that black stripe on the back of your card was the standard. The problem is, a magnetic stripe is incredibly simple and dumb. It's like having your credit card number, expiration date, and name written down on a piece of paper that never changes. When you swiped your card, the reader would simply read that static information. This made it very easy for thieves to install skimmers on machines that could copy that information and create a perfect functional clone of your card. It was a massive security flaw, and the solution was to put a tiny computer inside every single credit card. That small metallic square on the front of your card isn't just for decoration. It's a powerful microcomputer called an EMV chip. Its entire purpose is to play defense and act as your personal security guard. Instead of just blurting out your real credit card number for everyone to hear, it performs a brilliant piece of digital magic called tokenization. Think of it this way. Your actual credit card number is a valuable secret key. You don't want to hand that key to every merchant you do business with. So when the payment terminal asks for your information, the chip steps in and says, "Don't worry, I'll handle this." It uses a complex algorithm to generate a brand new, one-time-use set of numbers, a token, that is unique to that specific transaction, at that specific merchant, for that specific amount. This token is like a self-destructing secret password. It represents your real card number, but isn't actually your card number. The chip then passes this secure token to the payment terminal. And if you're tapping your card instead of inserting it, you're just using a technology called near-field communication, or NFC, which is a tiny radio antenna that does the exact same thing as the chip, just without the physical contact. The terminal then bundles this one-time token, along with the purchase amount and the merchant's information, into a tiny data packet. This is the authorization request. Now, even if a super hacker were to somehow intercept this information, it would be completely useless to them. That token is only good for that one coffee purchase and can never be used again. By turning your static, vulnerable account number into a dynamic, constantly changing secret code, the chip ensures the first step of your transaction's journey is incredibly secure. The acquiring bank receives this message in a fraction of a second. It quickly looks at the information and says, "Okay, this is a Visa card from a legitimate merchant." Its job now is to act as a dispatcher. It knows it can't approve the payment itself because it has no idea who you are or if you have enough money or credit. Its sole responsibility is to forward the request to the correct destination through the right channel. It immediately sends the authorization request hurtling down the vast, private, and incredibly secure digital highway of the card network. In this case, the Visa network. Think of the card network as the ultimate switchboard operator. It receives millions of these requests every minute from all over the world, and its job is to instantly route each one to the correct issuing bank. In less than the blink of an eye, Visa reads the data packet, identifies your bank based on your card number, and forwards the request to its final destination, the bank that issued you your card. Now the request has arrived at your bank's digital front door, and this is where the real decision is made. Your bank, the issuing bank, is the only one that truly knows you. Its first check is simple. It verifies that the one-time security token is valid, confirming the card is real and not a clone. But the next step is where the real magic happens. In that same millisecond, your bank becomes a brilliant digital detective, running a sophisticated fraud analysis powered by artificial intelligence. This system has spent years silently learning your financial personality. It knows you better than you know yourself, and its only job is to ask one simple question. Does this purchase feel like you? To answer that question, the AI runs through hundreds of data points, creating a risk score for the transaction. It's like a behavioral profiler looking for anything out of the ordinary. It asks, where is this purchase happening? If your last transaction was in your hometown an hour ago, and this one is in a different country, that's a major red flag for impossible travel. What kind of store is it? If you typically buy groceries and gas, a sudden $2,000 purchase at an online jewelry store is highly suspicious. What time is it? If your card is suddenly active at 3 a.m. when you're normally asleep, the system takes notice. It also checks the amount, the frequency of purchases, and for online transactions, even the device being used. A flurry of small, rapid-fire purchases, for example, is a classic sign of a thief testing a stolen card number. Based on this instantaneous analysis, the system gives the transaction a score. If the score is low, it's instantly approved. If the score is critically high, it's instantly declined, and you'll likely get an immediate text alert from your bank. And if the score falls into a middle, grey area, the system might trigger a confirmation text before approving the charge. Only after you've passed this rigorous, split-second security screening does the system move on to the final, most obvious check. Do you actually have enough available credit or a high enough balance to cover the cost of the coffee? Based on all these factors, security, fraud risk, and funds, your bank makes its final decision, approve or decline. An answer is generated, a simple yes or no code, and it begins its journey back. The approval code zips from your bank back to the Visa network. Visa's global switchboard instantly routes it back to the coffee shop's acquiring bank. The acquiring bank sees the yes code and forwards it to the specific payment terminal on the coffee shop counter. The terminal receives the code, the screen flashes approved, and the machine prints a receipt. This entire round trip, from the coffee shop in your town to your bank's data center hundreds of miles away and back again, has happened in the time it took you to put your wallet back in your pocket. And here's the most amazing part: no actual money has moved yet. All that just happened was the confirmation of a promise. The actual transfer of funds from your bank to the coffee shop's bank is a separate, slower process called settlement, which happens behind the scenes, usually while you sleep. So how does that promise of payment actually become real money in the coffee shop's bank account? This next part of the journey is slower, heavier, and happens in bulk, usually overnight. At the end of the business day, the coffee shop owner will perform a function on their terminal called batching out. Think of it like this. Instead of taking every single IOU they receive during the day to the bank one by one, they gather all of them up, put them in one giant digital envelope, and send the whole batch to their bank, the acquiring bank. This file contains the details of every approved transaction from that day: your coffee, the next person's muffin, and so on. Now the real accounting begins. The acquiring bank receives these batches from thousands of businesses. It sorts through them and forwards all the Visa transactions to Visa, all the MasterCard transactions to MasterCard, and so on. The card network now acts as a massive clearinghouse. Its job is to look at the billions of dollars in transactions from that day and figure out who owes what to whom. Instead of having your bank send $5 to the coffee shop's bank and 1,000 other banks send their own little payments, the network calculates the grand total. It might determine that, after everything is added up, all the issuing banks on the East Coast collectively owe all the acquiring banks on the West Coast a total of $500 million for that day. It's a process of massive scale reconciliation. Once the card network has done the math, it sends out the instructions. Finally, the actual real money moves. These are not the high-speed messages from before. These are large electronic fund transfers between the central accounts of the banks, often using a system called the Automated Clearinghouse, or ACH. Your bank sends the money for your coffee, bundled with millions of other payments, over to the coffee shop's bank. A day or two after you've already finished your drink, the money finally arrives in the coffee shop's account. So, every single credit card transaction is really two distinct events: a lightning-fast, individual conversation to authorize the purchase, followed by a much slower, behind-the-scenes group settlement to make sure everyone gets paid. But this incredible global machine, the secure networks, the fraud-detecting AIs, the massive data centers, obviously isn't free to run. It costs billions of dollars to maintain. This raises a crucial question. If you, the cardholder, are often using it for free, who actually pays for this amazing convenience? The answer is the merchant. For every single transaction, the coffee shop doesn't get to keep the full price of your coffee. A small percentage of your purchase, typically between 1% and 3%, is automatically deducted before the money ever reaches them. This deduction is a collection of fees, the biggest of which is called the interchange fee. Think of that interchange fee as a tiny slice of pie that the merchant has to give away, and that slice gets divided among the other players. The biggest piece of that slice goes to your bank, the issuing bank. Why them? Because they are taking on the most risk. They're the ones who lent you the credit in the first place. They're on the hook for covering any fraud losses if your card gets stolen, and they have to pay for any rewards programs you enjoy, like cash back or travel points. In a very real sense, the fee the merchant pays is what funds your airline miles. A smaller piece of the pie goes to the coffee shop's bank, the acquiring bank, for providing the payment terminal and processing the sales. And finally, the thinnest slice goes to the card network, like Visa or MasterCard, as payment for operating the global digital highway that makes it all possible. For a large corporation, this small fee is just the cost of doing business. But for a small business like our coffee shop, it can make a big difference. A 2% fee on a $5 cup of coffee might not seem like much, but when you multiply that by thousands of transactions, it adds up to a significant amount of money coming directly out of their profits. This is why you sometimes see small shops that have a minimum purchase amount for credit cards, or why they might seem happier when you choose to pay with cash. It's the price they pay to offer the speed, security, and convenience that most customers now expect. And while the merchant pays this fee directly, that cost is ultimately baked into the prices of everything we buy. So, in a way, we all chip in to keep the gears of this invisible, instantaneous, and incredible global system turning.